This is Passing Judgment, a podcast about the law and how it affects you. I'm your host, Loyola Law School professor Jessica Levinson. Think of me as your personal law professor as we navigate the big legal questions of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers. Hey, everybody, it's Jessica, and today I'm bringing you a conversation with Los Angeles Times reporter Sarah D. Wire. She covers, among other things, government accountability, the Justice Department, and national security. She's focused for a while now on January 6th and the insurrection at the Capitol and domestic extremism in general. We talked about her experience in the Capitol on January 6th. We talked about the pending cases against the former president. I loved this conversation that I had with her, and it really brought me inside and gave me a reporter's view of many of the most important topics that we are currently tackling as we enter the 2024 election. So here you are. Please enjoy. As always, rate, review, and subscribe. Sarah, welcome. I'm really looking forward to this conversation. You said something right before I pushed record, and you said the January 6th stuff is so important right now. And I'm hoping that you can pick up on that. And I know it might feel obvious because you live and breathe this, but I think people know what happened on January 6th. People have different views of exactly what they saw, but why is it so important for us to know about that now?
You know, in some ways, it was such a pivotal moment in American history that has been, in some ways, really brushed off. When you look at it in depth, like I have to every day, it was an attempt to override the will of voters. I mean, the foundation of democracy is that we give away some of our powers, but people do what we ask them to do. And this was such an important day, but we're heading into an election that's going to define how American history views January 6th and whether that was okay or not.
Do you have a shorthand of explaining to people in a neutral way as a journalist, what do you think did happen on January 6th? You said it was pivotal. I agree. You said it's something that goes to the heart of the type of government we have, right? A representative government where this is a self-governing democracy and we pride ourselves on the peaceful transfer of power. What did we see that day?
I think we saw the culmination of a plan that had been in place for several months. I can't say for sure whether anyone was intending violence at the White House when the plan began. But I think they thought, this was the final step in a pressure campaign that had already been underway for several months. We saw this through the January 6th hearings, that the sheer amount of evidence that has come out even since then has really kind of grounded the facts are all there. I just don't think a lot of people are fully grasp what those were. And I think the January 6th committee in particular was looking forward to the election subversion cases with Jack Smith and down in Fulton County as kind of validating everything they had found. And at this point, we don't even know if those cases are going to take place before the 2024 election.
And I want to get to those cases. Do you define January 6th as an insurrection?
I do, and so does the LA Times. It meets the dictionary definition, whether or not the crime has been charged. It meets the dictionary definition, and we always strive to be accurate. That's the most important thing.
Can you describe for us, I know it's been a while, but what was your experience on that day?
You and everyone else wants to hear about it. I'll be honest. It's going to be the first line of my obituary. I was in the chamber on January 6th, the House chamber, and I was among the last people evacuated. And, the floor had been evacuated. We could hear the rioters pounding on the doors, that door that the president walks in for the State of the Union. And police had told us all to scurry over to one side of the chamber and duck down behind the chairs and the marble walls. And people are praying. They're begging for their lives. You know, these are members of Congress. These are reporters. And I hear the crack, the gunshot that killed Ashley Babbitt. And I'd been a Cops and Courts reporter. I knew what that sound was. And I just had that moment of like, I could die up here. And I knew that if I wanted people to know that if I died, I died doing my job. And so something just kind of hit me and I crawled over to a member of Congress and started doing interviews.
Yeah.
Because there was going to be recordings on my phone inside the chamber. I'm the only reporter who was doing interviews inside the chamber. And I actually ended up inside the safe room with the members of Congress that afternoon.
I remember seeing pictures of you on that day. They were rough. It was hard to look. And it looked to me like you and our the representatives of our government very legitimately feared for their safety. This did not look like a fire drill to me. And who did you talk to? Who were the members? I think you spoke to, was it Norma Torres who was one of them?
Yeah, I spoke to Norma Torres first, and then I spoke with Jimmy Gomez. Jackie Spears was actually the first person to tell me to sit down because I was shaking so much in the safe room. You know, Eric Swalwell, Doug LaMalfa. You know, I was just grabbing as many California members of Congress as I could.
Were they willing to talk at that moment?
Yeah, there was three of us reporters in the safe room, and you know, finally a member got up and said, you know, we know there's some reporters in here. Please don't speak to them. They might give away our location.
Yeah.
And I remember just thinking to myself, lady, I'm in here too.
Right.
I'm not telling anyone where we are. And by the time we got to the safe room, you had to wade through police officers in full riot gear that were maybe five deep to get back to the room.
I know you've told the story many times. I didn't mean to force you to relive it. I do think that part of remembering why January 6th is important is remembering what your experience was on that day, because I do think it can start to feel academic. And I worry that it starts to feel academic when I think about it or write about it, in that I'm looking at statutes and I'm looking at the facts of the day. And I think what we forget is you having to pass through, I'm sure you don't forget it because you don't have the luxury of forgetting it, you know, five people in riot gear, you being in a safe room, you making sure that there were recordings on your phone so that people could hear that later. And I know that as a reporter, you have to answer this in a neutral way. I'm wondering if you are surprised, or however you want to answer this, that given the events of January 6th, that we are talking about another election of Biden versus Trump. And I'm wondering if you thought at that moment, maybe this is the end of Trump's political career.
Honestly, I didn't. But I wasn't thinking about the future of his political career at that point. At that point, when I look back through his presidency, there were so many moments where we thought this is the end of his political career.
Right.
You know, the Access Hollywood tape, the Muslim ban, the kids in cages. I mean, just boom, boom, boom. We kept thinking that this is going to be the end. And it wasn't. So in some way, why was this going to be any different? You know, I talked to members of Congress just in this last week or so, you know, members of the January 6th committee, and asked them, you know, were they surprised that this is where, you know, the country is right now? And they all said no, that, you know, the country had two choices and they figured this was probably going to be the choice they made.
Do you have a sense of why that is? I mean, why that wasn't career ending? Why the Muslim ban wasn't career ending? Why kids in cages wasn't career ending? Why any of those events that it seems to me conventional wisdom indicates that any candidate or representative would have been dead in the water, that nothing about conventional wisdom seems to hold here.
And I'm obviously not an expert in this, but, you know, in some ways, it's always come across that he speaks to people who feel like they're not heard.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's the source of his political power. And we're seeing that even now with, the 30% of Republicans who still support him, when you go to these rallies or things tangentially related to him, they still don't feel like they're being heard. And he's the only one who hears them and is going to do anything.
You just mentioned the January 6th committee and that you were talking to members of the January 6th committee. We're recording this episode on April 4th, and you have an article that came out, I think, at 2 a.m. my time today about members of the January 6th committee. And I'll let you summarize it, but my takeaway was that a number of them said, you really need to take the former president at his word, particularly when it comes to statements about using his powers to punish political opponents. I read in the very beginning of the article, you had interviewed Representative Lofgren, you had interviewed Representative Schiff, soon to be, I think, Senator Schiff, and they got into some detail about personal planning that they're doing and safety evaluations that they're thinking about in terms of what they would do if the former president is in fact elected again. Can you tell us, is that article, am I characterizing it correctly in the sense of this is about people who have investigated January 6th and for months and months and months saying, don't write off the words that the former president uses. And we feel that we will potentially be under threat.
Yeah. I mean, Adam Schiff even says that he has to take this seriously. Lofgren as well says that the one thing she learned from being on the committee was to take Trump at his word. I was surprised with how open they were willing to be with me for the story about making these plans, because, when you're in a position where your safety might be at risk, the natural thing to do is to not want to talk about it, not want to, blast it out to millions of readers of the LA Times. But it's important for us to periodically do these stories that remind people that these are humans too. And they are planning for the safety of themselves and their families because they're taking Donald Trump's word.
For me, that article was in a sense more impactful than here's what's going to happen to environmental policy if Biden or Trump wins, in the sense that I think it tells people what representatives are really feeling and what they're worried about, and it changes the stakes. And it's, again, this problem I think we have of things feeling abstract and academic. And, we will change environmental policy, or even the federal bench will change, I think feels very removed from people's daily lives. But then when you read a piece, and I thought this was why it's so important that you wrote it, about Adam Schiff planning for his safety and the safety of his staffers, it lands different.
Yeah. I mean, you've got someone who is hoping to be a U.S. senator come January, at the same time as preparing for what he has to do to make sure that he is physically safe if a Republican holds the White House.
Right. Here's something else that we were talking about before I pushed the record button. You have a lot of beats right now. We've been focusing on January 6th, but what's a day in the life like for you?
Still figuring that out. My beat is the Justice Department, national security. I'm covering the Trump trials and January 6th, when we're still learning about what happened and the planning before and afterwards. But also now I cover Congress. And so balancing those two, those multiple beats has become a lot. I try to go into Washington a couple of days a week and put in FaceTime on the Hill. And we're really focused on writing about California right now at the LA Times. And it was my first love. It was my first job at the Times. So I'm enjoying getting to know these members of Congress again. But what's happening with the Trump trials? I mean, that's going to be April 15th. I'll probably be up in New York, with jury selection and the New York hush money case. And, if the other cases manage to get a trial date, I'll be there as well. And just kind of balancing out all those things, because it's important that we continue to cover an insurrection.
And let's talk about those trials a little bit. As you said, April 15th, the first criminal case that will not be brought, but that will actually happen. And of course, against a former president, the former president was charged with what I think some people view as bookkeeping crimes. And I'm going to try and summarize this case. And then I want to ask you for what do you think is important to highlight for your readers when you're going to New York? So as I understand it, this case obviously deals with 34 counts of the falsification of business records. This sometimes would be a misdemeanor, but this is actually a felony trial because part of how you can bump this case up to a felony is that you can say that the falsification of business records essentially was done in order to try and commit or conceal another crime. And part of the legal question I think that a lot of people will be looking at is, what exactly is Alvin Bragg, the district attorney in the case, and his team, what exactly are they going to point to in terms of the other crimes? Will there be New York election and tax crimes? That makes some sense because we're talking about a state prosecutor, but we're also talking about a federal candidate. Will it be federal crimes? And that makes sense because we're talking about a federal candidate. And the facts, very briefly, are about the former president kind of indirectly, allegedly paying off Stormy Daniels. And then there's also payments dealing with Karen McDougal and a doorman, but focusing on Stormy Daniels really and paying her for her silence of her alleged story that she allegedly had an affair with the former president, and the payment being made to ensure that she didn't share that story right before the election. And so that will be one of the issues. Is the payment personal, or is the payment made in furtherance of the election? And the fact that it just took me a while to explain it, I think, is one of the reasons why there's some sense that maybe this isn't the strongest case pending against the former president. But what do you think is important for people going into this trial to know? What do you want to make sure to highlight, you know, as the trial begins?
I think you pegged it really well there, that this is not a trial about the crime that's being charged isn't the payment. It's being the cover-up, the way in which Trump repaid Michael Cohen for making that original payment through his business. It's going to be important for people to think about, would this story about an alleged sexual encounter have changed their vote? You know, this was right on the heels of the Access Hollywood tape. Trump and his campaign were a bit on their heels. I remember running around Capitol Hill asking every Republican member of the California delegation whether they still could support him after hearing that tape. And his support was dropping quickly, at least among, you know, members of Congress. And, you know, so that's going to be a key thing that I think Bragg is going to try to hammer down is, you know, that's why people like Trump's campaign spokeswoman, Hope Hicks, is expected to be a witness to, she might not have been a witness to the settlement, but perhaps to discussions about how her alleged story would have influenced the campaign's outcome.
Right. And therefore, why she's going to explain this isn't to try and make sure Melania didn't find out about the affair. This is to try and make sure that the American public didn't find out about it. And I think that's why, in my view, it will be so important for Bragg and the prosecution team to frame this as actually another election interference case. So we have other cases dealing with the 2020 election. But I think what Bragg is trying to say is, hush money itself is not illegal. I mean, I can pay you to stay silent, and it depends on the context, but that alone isn't going to give rise to criminal liability. It's trying to corruptly subvert an election by buying somebody's silence and potentially violating a federal or state law in the process. Do we have more information at this point about exactly what Bragg is going to point to in terms of those other laws that would kick this up into a felony? I mean, I've been trying to follow the case fairly closely, and really what I've seen is there's a New York election law that deals with kind of conspiracy to subvert the election. I'm paraphrasing it. There are potential state and federal tax issues. And then, of course, there's the federal election law where the argument could be made that $130,000 to Stormy Daniels could be viewed as a campaign contribution. It's more than the $2,700 limit, and it's not disclosed. Is that the universe of the other laws that we're looking at here?
I believe so. And it's going to be really interesting to see which avenue Bragg decides to go down. You know, there's some question if a state prosecutor can enforce federal mm-hmm. election law. And that's actually tripped him up a little bit in the past. So I think he's going to stick with the New York election subversion route. But again, Trump's not being directly charged with that. So Bragg has to bring that up as something related without it actually being what he's charged with.
Right. And he doesn't have to show proof beyond a reasonable doubt that New York election law was violated. He has to show that Trump had the intent to commit or conceal a violation of the New York election law.
Exactly.
So, as always, jury selection will be key. Now, there are other cases that I know you're following that deal not with the 2016 election, but with the 2020 election instead. And there's the federal election interference case. There's the Georgia election interference case. I heard you say this before, but is it your view that you think this is the New York hush money case is the only case that goes to trial before the election?
Well, it's the only one with a trial date so far. Now, the Supreme Court is supposed to hear an oral argument at the end of April about whether Trump has presidential immunity and can claim that when it comes to the election subversion case in the federal level. You know, what we've seen so far, I think they might wait until the end of June to hand down that opinion when their session ends. And that means that, you know, a trial could potentially start in August or September. It doesn't have to wait because of the election. Jack Smith said that in one of his most recent filings that, you know, they're not restricted by not bringing charges within 60 days because these charges have already been brought. But the case can continue because the charges have already been.
Right. And listeners of the podcast know this. You're referring to the April 25th date where there will be oral arguments before the Supreme Court on, as you said, the question of whether or not a former president enjoys absolute and or qualified immunity. It's really or not and qualified immunity based on official acts. And we actually don't have a Supreme Court decision on this case. I previewed it for my constitutional law students when we talked about the cases that we do have and how we can reason by analogy. This is a little bit in the weeds, but the trial court judge in this case, Judge Chutkan, in my understanding, had really already ruled that many of the statements here are not official statements, that this was candidate Trump, not President Trump. And therefore, I'm wondering if you have a sense of why strategically Special Counsel Jack Smith didn't say, you know what, maybe we shouldn't wait on the Supreme Court and this whole immunity issue. Let's just move forward on those statements where Judge Chutkan has said they're not official statements. Let's have this trial. Did he not want to kind of cleave those statements out? Was there a fear that you think though there could still be an appeal based on whether or not those truly were official statements? Was it that we're actually waiting on another case dealing with January 6th from the Supreme Court and whether or not the obstruction statute is a good fit for people involved in January 6th? Do you have a sense of why Jack Smith said, we're just waiting?
Well, Trump was wanting to claim presidential immunity for not just statements, but for actions.
Right.
And I think that's where you really get tripped up, is that, you know, it would have been really easy to cleave statements out of the case, but his actions, how do you cleave those out? And that's the root of what Smith is trying to charge. And so, you know, Trump was trying to apply it to both.
Yeah, right. That's really, and saying maybe it's on the outer ambit, see these other cases, but it still does fall within official statements and official actions. That is obviously the federal election interference case. And again, we're waiting for the Supreme Court, in my view, really for two decisions. One in a case not involving the former president about whether or not the obstruction statute that Special Counsel Jack Smith used in half of his, that amounts to half of the charges, really is a good fit for January 6th. And then, of course, there's the Georgia election interference case. And there was just some breaking news about Mar-a-Lago. Can you remind us That is the document retention case dealing with the former president allegedly holding on to government documents containing highly sensitive information and refusing to give them back time and time again to the federal government. What's the latest in that case?
So on April 4th, Judge Cannon did finally rule that Trump cannot claim that these documents were his under the Presidential Records Act. And, you know, the Presidential Records Act basically outlines what documents belong to the American people and need to go to the National Archives, and what documents belong to a president and he can take home with him when he leaves office. There's really no teeth to law. In the past, if a president has taken home things that he shouldn't, then the National Archives goes to him quietly and asks for them back, and he hands them over, and it never really becomes national news. He does occasionally. But every administration has had this, where a president has taken home something that they shouldn't. You know, Jack Smith brought this case in the Mar-a-Lago documents case, not under the Presidential Records Act. Because like I said, it has no real teeth. He brought this under CISA, because these are classified documents. You know, Smith's argument is that classified documents don't belong to the White House or to the president. They belong to the agency that created them. So if the CIA created a document for a president to look at, the CIA is supposed to get that document back afterwards. And so he's just completely circumventing the Presidential Records Act, saying it does not apply in any way to this case. And so Judge Cannon finally, you know, issued a ruling in that, saying that no, Trump can't claim that during trial, that the documents were his under the Presidential Records Act.
Can I ask why you bookended that answer by using the word finally? Because I actually think it is important here. And I'm not, in my view, using the word finally is not your personal view. I think it is an accurate description of what's happening here. And so you introduced Judge Cannon's ruling and you kind of outroed it by saying finally. And I agree. That is the objective way of defining what's happening. But why is that accurate?
She has a very backlogged docket at the moment of things that are awaiting ruling. Biggest of which is to set a trial date. You know, more than a month ago, she asked, you know, Trump's lawyers and prosecutors to propose filing dates and trial dates. And she's waited so long that dates suggested by Jack Smith are no longer relevant because they've been passed. You know, there are a lot of important rulings that are just waiting to be made. And some of those, if he doesn't make them soon, it's really difficult for the special counsel to appeal or for, you know, Trump's lawyers to appeal them.
And we know that the Trump defense team strategy has been delay, delay, delay. And so anytime a judge is not moving quickly, and we can contrast Judge Chutkan in D.C. with Judge Cannon in Florida, that is a win for Team Trump. Now, as a reporter, do you have a sense of how important it is for the American public to have the information about these trials before the election? I mean, do you think that people overplay the idea that we really need to, there's a public interest in having these trials? Because the counter to that is, well, we know the allegations. We know a lot about both of these candidates. As somebody who educates the public every day, do you think it would be the better path to allow these trials to play out before the election?
I think you're right that a lot of people have made up their mind about what happened. They've already, you know, just the same way that a lot of people have, you know, preconceptions about both Trump and Biden going into the election. You know, this is not a introduction type of campaign. But I mean, even from Trump's perspective, if he is innocent, you know, the American people deserve to know that before the campaign. I mean, I think it would change people's minds the same way that it might change people's minds if he is guilty, for the American people to know that before the election. I think that's why it's so important, is to have someone, some kind of definitive answer. You know, it's not just the January 6th committee came up with this report and it was mostly led by Democrats, so you hate it if you're a Republican, or, you know, the Republican led House Administration Committee is currently issuing their own reports and trying to gin up, you know, evidence that you know, Democrats had hid things about that would have exonerated Trump, you know, it wouldn't just be people getting information from their own media ecosystem. It would be the courts saying definitively, he's innocent or guilty.
Right. And that I think that's a very important point to emphasize. I have now kept you longer than the time that I asked for. So I will end with this question, which is there something that you wish people knew about your job? I think people have a lot of views of the media, either in general, positive or negative, and or a lot of even well-meaning misconceptions about what reporters actually do and what their job is. Is there something that you wish people understood about what your role as a member of the Fourth Estate, what it is that made you say, yes, my life is under threat, but I'm going to go ahead and start recording because I want people to hear this conversation?
You'll have to excuse me for getting in a high horse for just a split second, but you know, the founding fathers put freedom of the press and the First Amendment for a reason. For democracy to work, for you know, us to give up part of our power and have representatives vote on our behalf, we have to know what those representatives are doing on our behalf. We have an obligation as citizens to know what's happening in our government. And that's how I view my job every day. I have an obligation as a fellow citizen to tell people what happened. I don't work for politicians. They're not my friends. I don't go out drinking with them or have dinner or go to parties. We can be friendly without being friends, but I don't work for them. I work for, you know, people who read the LA Times and anyone else who wants to know what's happening in their government.
As somebody who teaches the First Amendment, I will say that horse wasn't nearly as high as I thought it could have been. So I think you hit that exactly right. Sarah, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.